Today is Monday, November 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The number of COVID-19 cases in the United States continues to rise.
Average daily cases in our state have doubled just in the last 2 weeks. It cannot go on like this.
Plus, Peru's president steps down.
Marino's departure leaves the country back in limbo and without a leader.
And Ethiopia says it has captured more towns in the northern Tigray region. We'll have these stories and more next. A second coronavirus vaccine is showing promise in the United States. AP correspondent Mike Hempen starts us off.
Moderna says preliminary data from an ongoing study show its vaccine is nearly 95% effective. Last week, Pfizer announced its own COVID-19 vaccine appeared similarly effective. Both companies are now on track to seek permission within weeks for emergency use in the U.S. Virus cases in the country topped 11 million over the weekend. Moderna President Dr. Stephen Hoge says having similar results from two different companies is most reassuring. Hoge says it's going to require many vaccines to meet global demand. I'm Mike Hempen.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is self-isolating after coming into contact with someone who tested positive for COVID-19. A fresh setback after infighting among his top advisors plunged Downing Street into chaos last week. Reuters Flora Bradley Watson takes things from here.
Boris Johnson met Lee Anderson and other lawmakers in Downing Street last Thursday. Anderson subsequently developed COVID-19 symptoms and tested positive. Johnson took to Twitter on Sunday to announce he had been contacted by NHS Test and Trace. "I have no symptoms, but I'm following the rules," he tweeted, adding that he would be working from home leading the government's pandemic response. It's another major setback for Johnson following last week's resignation of Dominic Cummings, his chief advisor, and Lee Kane, his communications chief. Weekend newspapers were full of reports of bitter infighting at Downing Street, painting a picture of a government in chaos. In an attempt to show he's still got a grip on things, Johnson's office said he will make a string of announcements over the next 2 weeks on issues from the pandemic to green policy. This is not Johnson's first brush with the disease. He was admitted to intensive care in a London hospital earlier this year with COVID-19 and credits healthcare workers with saving his life.
Flora Bradley Watson reports for Reuters News. According to data from Johns Hopkins University, the U.S. is adding about 1 million new COVID-19 cases a week, and deaths averaged 820 a day as of Saturday. AP correspondent Shelley Adler reports.
The United States is in a heap of trouble.
Lawrence Gostin, a professor of global health law at Georgetown University.
We've got not just COVID cases, but also hospitalizations and deaths rising at an unprecedented rate.
And Gostin is concerned that it doesn't appear like anything will change.
It looks very much like the White House and including Vice President Pence's coronavirus task force is just sidelined and uninterested in intervening.
Deaths due to COVID are up 33% over the past 2 weeks, according to Johns Hopkins University. Shelley Adler, Washington.
In the Pacific Northwest state of Washington, Governor Jay Inslee painted a bleak picture.
Average daily cases in our state have doubled just in the last 2 weeks. It cannot go on like this. We have to get this under control, or our medical system will soon be overwhelmed.
With the recent increase in coronavirus cases, the United States surpassed 11 million infections, and several governors of U.S. states are instituting new restrictions to try and slow the spread of COVID-19. More than 246,000 have died from COVID-19 in the United States, the most in a single country of the world's more than 1.3 million coronavirus fatalities. VOA has continued pandemic coverage of the world's more than 54.4 million cases on our website. U.S. President Donald Trump, for the first time on Sunday, tweeted that Democrat Joe Biden, quote, won the presidential election nearly 2 weeks ago, but said that he was not conceding, calling the election rigged. Twitter flagged Trump's claim, saying, quote, "This claim about election fraud is disputed." Election officials throughout the country have told VOA and other news organizations that they have not uncovered any evidence of widespread fraud, only some small election day and vote counting problems that would not reverse Biden's victory. While several legal disputes about the election remain to be heard in U.S. courts in several political battleground states, Trump already has lost numerous cases that allege voting and vote counting irregularities. Some of the disputes involved much smaller numbers of disputed ballots that even if Trump had prevailed, it would not have overturned Biden's victories in individual states. Trump's refusal to acknowledge Biden's victory in the highly contentious election is unprecedented in modern U.S. politics, although there is no law saying that he must concede. Over the weekend, thousands of protesters marched in Washington on Saturday supporting President Trump and his unproven claims of widespread voter fraud in the November 3rd election. Mike O'Sullivan reports that supporters of President-elect Joe Biden also rallied, demanding an orderly transition of presidential power.
All the pictures together.
They converged on the nation's capital, getting a thumbs up from President Donald Trump, who drove by in his motorcade. Despite an absence of evidence, they say President-elect Joe Biden stole the election.
We hope that the nation will heal by listening to our voice so that we know that we will have a fair election. All the legitimate and fair votes and legal votes will be counted.
The far-right self-described Western chauvinists, Proud Boys, were among the protesters. So were groups billed as Women for America First, Million MAGA March, and Stop the Steal DC. There was name-calling as Biden supporters confronted the demonstrators and some skirmishes and arrests, but the march and a rally at the U.S. Supreme Court were mostly peaceful. Encouraged by President Trump, many protesters believe the election results were altered with fraudulent ballots or rigged voting machines.
And they can turn automatically the votes. This is why they had to recount one by one.
A close count in Georgia triggered an automatic recount, which is being done by hand.
If there's one vote that is fraudulent, that's enough for me. This isn't a research project. I'm not looking for statistically significant stuff. I'm looking for one evidence of voter fraud.
But that won't make a difference, say election experts. Most analysts say recounts and legal challenges in individual states are unlikely to change the result of the election.
We hope Trump wins, but if he doesn't, the world will go on.
These Trump supporters say it's not over yet, and Trump insists he has no plan to concede.
If President Trump concedes, then of course we're going to accept that too.
With or without a concession, President-elect Biden will take office on January 20th. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News.
Peru's interim president, Manuel Merino, resigned on Sunday, leaving the country in limbo and without a leader after lawmakers demanded that he step down following the deaths of two people in protests over the sudden ouster of his predecessor. Reuters' Brian Wood reports.
Merino was appointed by Congress following the impeachment of former President Martin Vizcarra. But after a week of some of Peru's largest protests in decades, Merino's departure leaves the country back in limbo and without a leader.
At this moment, when the country is going through one of its greatest political crises, I want to announce to all the country that I present my irrevocable resignation of the post of the presidency of the Republic. I call for the peace and unity of all Peruvians.
Peruvians poured into the streets Sunday to celebrate Merino's departure, waving flags, chanting, and banging pots. But this past week has been far from a celebration. Clashes between protesters and police in the streets have continued since Congress took a sudden vote last Monday to remove Vizcarra over bribery allegations. Vizcarra, a political centrist, has been widely popular with Peruvians. Since being removed, he's called Merino a dictator installed by Congress and warned against allowing lawmakers to once again determine who would become Peru's next leader. Many of the demonstrators agreed.
The people did not choose you, Marino. Stop with the repression.
Two young protesters had died from gunshot wounds in this week's clashes, according to state medical officials. Peru's national human rights coordinator said over 100 people were injured, some after inhaling tear gas, and dozens were still missing. The latest political shakeup comes as Peru faces what is expected to be its worst economic recession in a century from the global health crisis. The country's next presidential elections are scheduled for April next year.
That was Reuters reporter Brian Wood. And coming up later...
3, 2, 1, 0.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
It's known that Earth's only natural satellite is the moon. There have also been a number of objects, usually asteroids, that have fallen under the influence of Earth's gravity to become what some call secondary moons. NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory says a tiny new secondary moon of Earth was discovered in mid-September by the Pan-STARRS 1 survey telescope in Hawaii. The Minor Planet Center in Cambridge, Massachusetts, designated the object as 2020 SO. What makes this secondary moon so unique is that it's not an asteroid or a natural object, but is actually the booster stage of a rocket that helped send the Surveyor 2 lander to the moon in 1966. JPL says it will only be a temporary satellite and will return to a solar orbit after a few months. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's government said Monday it had captured another town in the northern Tigray region after nearly 2 weeks of fighting in a conflict already spilling into Eritrea and destabilizing the wider Horn of Africa. Hundreds have died, at least 20,000 refugees have fled to Sudan, and there have been reports of atrocities since Abiy ordered airstrikes and a ground offensive against Tigray's rulers for defying his authority. The conflict could jeopardize a recent economic opening, stir up ethnic bloodshed elsewhere around Africa's second most populous nation, and tarnish the reputation of Abiy, who won a Nobel Peace Prize last year for a peace pact with Eritrea. On Sunday, the leader of Ethiopia's Tigray region says his forces had fired rockets at Eritrea, who he accuses of sending troops into his region. Reuters reporter David Doyle has that part of the story.
Mengistab Abrakai says he doesn't know where his children are. Like at least 20,000 others, according to the United Nations, he's fled Ethiopia's Tigray region amid an escalating conflict in which it has been claimed neighboring Eritrea is now involved. At the Sudanese border town of Hamdayet, Mengistab says he ran from looting, stealing and killing. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed sent the military into Tigray after accusing forces there of attacking the national army. On Sunday, Tigray's leader, Debretsion Gebru Mekel, accused neighboring Eritrea of also sending in tanks and thousands of troops and said his forces had retaliated with rockets fired at the Eritrean capital. It's precisely the kind of escalation that raises fears the regional conflict could spread in the Horn of Africa. But with communications cut and access to Tigray limited, reports are difficult to verify. Certainly, there's no love lost between Tigray and Eritrea. The former was on the front line of the 1998-2000 Ethiopia-Eritrea War. And though Abiy won a Nobel Prize for making peace with his northern neighbor, Eritrea remains distrustful of the Tigrayan leadership. On Sunday, Abiy said Ethiopia was capable of achieving its objectives in Tigray by itself, without specifically addressing Debretsion's claim. Government officials in Ethiopia and Eritrea could not be immediately reached for comment, though Eritrea's foreign minister last week denied his country had sent troops. However, in Hamdayet, several refugees did claim their areas had been shelled from the Eritrean side. Several regional diplomats also backed up Debretsion's report of rockets being fired at the Eritrean capital, Asmara, saying three were fired from Ethiopia on Saturday, with at least two hitting the airport. Rockets were also allegedly fired at two airports in Amhara State, which borders Tigray to the south. The Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, which governs Tigray and is chaired by Debretsion, said that was retaliation for government airstrikes in their region. Abiy's government says the strikes are targeting arms depots controlled by the battle-hardened Tigrayan forces, who experts say possess significant military hardware.
That was Reuters' David Doyle. The top United Nations official for Libya says its rival sides have wrapped up a week of talks in Tunisia without agreeing on a transitional government to lead the country to an election in December of next year. The 75-member forum did not discuss names during the week-long talks, but will gather virtually within a week to agree on a mechanism to name the next government. Many Libyans are skeptical about the process that has followed nearly a decade of chaos and bloodshed and repeated previous efforts to resolve the country's divisions. Schools in Hong Kong received new guidance on conducting classes to be compliant under the city's new national security law. On Monday, over 1,000 teachers attended official training seminars on the matter. Reporter Ria Mogul is in Hong Kong, and I spoke to her via WhatsApp to get the details.
So this new academic year, which only began about 3 months ago in August, has seen numerous new instructions from the government on ways schools should instill and strengthen national security awareness and national education in Hong Kong. Now, for a bit of background, national education was actually introduced back in 2007 to nurture patriotism among students towards China. But in recent months, since the sweeping national security law was implemented by Beijing, schools have been receiving more and more instructions from the government than previous years. These include, for instance, raising the national flag and playing China's national anthem at least 5 times a year. Schools as well have been urged to do more to instill national identity in terms of classroom activities, by using the school bulletin boards, by putting on exhibitions, and the government are introducing more trainings as well for teachers. As you said today, about 1,000 attended this lecture about national security in Hong Kong, where we believe new guidelines and changes to the school syllabus are due to be implemented.
Ria, this is not the first time that Beijing has given guidance to Hong Kong and its educational system. Can you kind of walk us through the context on how this guidance kind of differs from that previously?
Yeah, that's right. So teachers have spoken to various media outlets and said that it's, and I quote, unlike anything that they've ever seen before. Principals are inclined to do as they are told. And it's not just teachers that have noticed these changes. Students have also reported an increase, for instance, in the number of videos that have been played in classrooms, which are related to the basic law, which is Hong Kong's mini constitution and national identity, and the number of activities planned, which are aimed at instilling a sense of national pride amongst the student body, has increased. China's ruling Communist Party has seen education as a crucial ideological tool for creating loyal citizens. Now, under Xi Jinping, the party has, ramped up their patriotic education on the mainland. And since last year's anti-government, pro-democracy protests, Beijing has clamped down on Hong Kong education as well. And since the introduction of these sweeping new national security laws, more and more has been done in schools to implement a sense of national identity and national pride.
Ria Mogul reports from Hong Kong. Elon Musk's rocket company SpaceX launched 4 astronauts on a flight to the International Space Station on Sunday, NASA's first full-fledged mission sending a crew into orbit aboard a privately owned spacecraft. Reuters' Eve Johnson has that story.
3, 2, 1, 0.
SpaceX launched 4 astronauts into orbit on Sunday, marking a major milestone for NASA. It was their first full-fledged mission on board a privately owned spacecraft.
And resilience rises. Not even gravity contains humanity when we explore as one for all.
The Resilience is SpaceX's newly designed Crew Dragon capsule. It blasted off atop the company's Falcon 9 rocket from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. A big win for billionaire Elon Musk, who founded the company. Astronaut Commander Mike Hopkins described the launch as, quote, one heck of a ride. The crew headed to the International Space Station, some 250 miles or 400 kilometers above Earth, a 27-hour trip. Ahead of liftoff, the astronauts fitted in their custom white suits, driven out to the launch pad in SUVs made by Tesla, another of Musk's companies. The other NASA crew included Victor Glover, reportedly the first black astronaut to live aboard the orbiting laboratory, and physicist Shannon Walker. Japanese astronaut Soichi Noguchi was also on board on his third trip to space. Sunday's launch puts NASA back in the ring 9 years after ending its space shuttle program and signals a new era of cooperation with private companies. But SpaceX's Elon Musk was not there to watch the successful liftoff. Just 2 days earlier, he said he, quote, most likely had a moderate case of COVID-19. SpaceX and NASA have conducted contact tracing and determined Musk had not come into contact with anyone who interacted with the astronauts. The mission is expected to last about 6 months.
Eve Johnson reports for Reuters News. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, tablet, desktop computer, or any other device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is committed to the robust pursuit of international justice. Unique among foreign ministries worldwide, the State Department has a special office specifically devoted to dealing with mass atrocities. As Ambassador at Large Morse Tan, who heads the Office of Global Criminal Justice, pointed out in a recent interview.
We're talking genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and whatever we can do to help prevent, mitigate, or address these sorts of injustices, these gross injustices, these horrible injustices. That's what we're all about.
Ambassador Tan said his office advises the Secretary of State and helps leverage the vast resources of the entire U.S. government on matters relating to global criminal justice.
Whether it's economic, whether it's diplomatic, whether it's legal, whether it is even military, there's a whole array of different tools that the U.S. government has at its disposal. And we are the policy shop, if you will.
Ambassador Tan said the Office of Global Criminal Justice shares the same fundamental mission as the International Criminal Court, to bring those responsible for mass atrocities to justice. But because of issues like sovereignty, the U.S. has never been a party to the Rome Statute that created the ICC. And unfortunately, the ICC has deviated from its mandate as a court of last resort, established to investigate and prosecute the worst international crimes. Instead, Ambassador Tan declared, the ICC has become politicized and corrupt. It is the United States, he said, that continues to lead the world in pursuing accountability for mass atrocities.
ICC is not the only game in town in terms of international courts. For mixed or hybrid courts that are part domestic, part international, as well as domestic courts. And that's true in the Special Tribunal in Lebanon, the Specialist Chambers of Kosovo, the IIIM, which is trying to gather information in regards to atrocities committed in Syria, or the IIIM, which is trying to gather evidence in regards to atrocities committed in Myanmar. We support all these things, and we also help in terms of evidence collection.
Ambassador Tan said the United States is utterly committed and determined in its quest for global justice. Thinking about those who have suffered from these mass atrocities gives strong motivation, he said. And if anything, we are extending and increasing our resources to pursue this mission.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.